from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and tomorrow marks the dedication of the $3.5 billion National Ignition Facility site at Livermore Lab, which advocates believe will create fusion from 192 lasers made of nearly 60 miles of mirrors and fiber optics, crystals, and light amplifiers designed to fire off and make hydrogen fuel tinier than a BB or the head of a match. First fired off in February, the National Ignition Facility now represents the world's most powerful laser and the biggest optical instrument ever constructed. But as the New York Times reported, will it be fusion or will it be folly? Well, we focus on the project in this half-hour segment, and let me tell you who is joining us. I want to welcome first Raymond Jean-Lo, who is professor of astronomy and professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us by phone from Berkeley's campus. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you with us. Also good to have David Perlman, science editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And good morning, David.
Good to you, Michael.
David, let me begin with you. What does Friday represent? What does all the big hoopla tomorrow represent?
Well, all the big hoopla represents primarily the fact that this monster machine facility is going to be dedicated by, among other people, Stephen Chu, formerly of Berkeley and noted Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and now the Secretary of Energy in the Obama administration. So they've completed building this facility, have yet to start any experiments with it, but it's being formally dedicated, as happens all the time with big machines like that.
Now, we should mention Governor Schwarzenegger will be there as well.
Oh,
tomorrow.
Lots of people will be there.
Ed Moses, who heads up this project, says it's like a cathedral, it's like building an A-bomb, it's like going to the moon, inventing the airplane. Does that strike you as hyperbole?
Well, we're all given to hyperbole. I would say that it is one of the most amazing machines if it succeeds, and that's one never knows. One probably won't know until the next 2, 3, 4 years before it really reaches peak energy production.
Well, I guess in many people's minds, as I said, this is just a lot of waste of money. Cost overruns and delays have been characteristic of it. It was supposed to be completed back in 2002. If you were putting bets on the likelihood that we're going to see fusion out of this, what would you say at this point?
I would not dream of putting a bet on it because I'm not qualified. I don't have enough technical knowledge. But from the folks I've talked to, there's a kind of mixture. There was an old once classified report by a group called JASON, which is a very high-level group of scientists recruited by the Defense Department, which says that it is, among other things, among the notorious unknown unknowns. And it says also the large physical scale and high complexity of the ignition experimental campaign places it firmly at the forefront of experimental physics. Well, experiments sometimes fail and sometimes don't fail, but even when they fail, people, scientists at least, learn a heck of a lot from the failure. So I don't know, and I don't think anybody else knows for sure yet.
Well, if it is a failure, it's about $140 million a year failure in terms of what it's been costing.
Professor, and a couple of billion dollars to build it.
And a couple of billion to build, right. We're talking about a 33-foot wide target chamber just by itself. And Professor Jean-Lo, let's get you into this, just kind of explaining how this might work, if indeed it would work. It's sort of like how the sun works. I mean, converting hydrogen atoms into helium.
That's right. And so the ultimate goal, of course, is to create thermonuclear ignition or fusion, not to be confused with a normal chemical burning, but really a nuclear kind of chemistry. And at the end of the day, our interest as human beings is quite frankly self-centered, because it is that form of energy that's produced in the sun that allows us to actually survive on the surface of the Earth. So that's the backdrop for trying to do these kinds of experiments and understand, if you want, the physics and the chemistry of nuclear fusion. I would take a small exception to the characterization of success or failure, because one could argue already the project has been very successful in just getting as far as it has. There have been huge technical challenges that have had to be addressed in creating a laser of this scale, which is far larger than anything that has been produced before in terms of laser power or size or performance, by perhaps a factor of 100-fold increase or almost 1,000-fold. And so just even accomplishing the task to date and surmounting the technical hurdles, which required scientific and engineering research to get to this point, and additionally required then industrializing the processes. I'm happy to go into more details. I don't want to bore you with them or dwell on them. But the point is, already a lot of money has been spent to get to this point, and that's because huge advances have been made in understanding the technical challenges or confronting the technical challenges and then actually getting companies to produce the components to the tolerances and put them together and so on and so forth. And so I'd say already there's quite a bit of success for what's been done. And I would also point out that regardless of the challenges of fusion, that's the ultimate goal, there will be many scientific successes, no doubt, no matter what happens and how challenging thermonuclear fusion turns out to be in a laboratory.
But if indeed there is success in the context that it's often been used, and I understand your apprehension about using it in a totally generic way, but if there's that kind of success where fusion is concerned, hydrogen atoms fusing to helium and releasing these bursts of thermonuclear energy, then the likelihood or the possibility of no more underground testing, of new types of power plants, of limitless carbon-free energy, and even in your whole realm, the hidden life of stars and what we can learn is just extraordinary, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we as humans have very limited understanding of the physics and chemistry of nuclear fusion. And I would then go beyond that. Were we able to harness that form of energy and the processes that take place when that kind of energy is present, if you want to transition from not just the basic scientific understanding, but even to perhaps in the future, I'll call it an engineering and almost an industrialized understanding of nuclear fusion, that would be a completely new realm of capability for we as humans. Now, large amounts of power are in some ways a frightening thing to think about, and we can question how well we'll be able to control these processes. But the point is right now is to nibble away at the edges of a field that we've known about, that is a set of processes we know about, because they do power the stars on the one hand, but on the other hand, that we as a human species have heretofore not really had the opportunity to dig into and really understand in any detail.
Then what are the dangers or perils involved in all of this as you see it?
Well, I aside from the possibility of a failure in the sense of having unanticipated challenges to reaching fusion and the like, I actually think that I would like to downplay any notion that there could be some unintended consequences of these kinds of experiments. And here I want to tread a little bit carefully. I said that we as humans have not controlled fusion, but of course I should remind you and your listeners, who many of whom well know, that we have as humans have created fusion reactions before, namely through the explosion of thermonuclear weapons. And so in some sense, one could say, well, it's nothing new. We humans have created nuclear fusion. And in that sense, we know that what will happen in this national ignition facility, even if it exceeds its expectations of achieving fusion, is in no way going to endanger us or create a new kind of unanticipated physics. All of that has already been demonstrated through underground nuclear explosions of the past. Now, as far as we know, we don't foresee any underground nuclear explosions in the future, and some, in fact, view NIF as a means of sustaining our nuclear arsenal. In fact, this is in many ways the primary argument that was put forward for the funding of the National Ignition Facility, is it's part of a program of activities to sustain our U.S. nuclear deterrent. Having said that, I just wanted to...
Well, excuse me, a lot of that has to do with maintenance and retesting to find out if these are still viable.
That's correct. And maintaining, let me say, technical expertise in the domain of nuclear weapons. Now, this quickly becomes a very controversial and appropriately an emotional subject. I don't want to extract us off the main point of the National Ignition Facility. But indeed, one of the real reasons for establishing this facility is to maintain this expertise of the U.S. deterrent. And frankly, I'll speak now personally, that's regardless of the size of the U.S. arsenal, whether we have a large arsenal, a small arsenal, and so on and so forth, maintaining the expertise is part of the intention of this facility.
Again, Raymond Genlot is professor of astronomy and professor of Earth and Planetary Science at the University of California, Berkeley. And let me give the phone number out, because I know there are many of you who probably have questions or would like to comment on the National Ignition Facility. Again, on Friday, tomorrow, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory will unveil the National Ignition Facility, which the lab says will help develop alternatives to nuclear weapons testing, as we're hearing, but also produce fusion-based energy and shed light on perhaps the origins of the universe. By the way, you can see photos and more KQED TV and radio coverage of the National Ignition Facility by visiting kqed.org/quest. If you'd like to join us, if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, we welcome your calls. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, and lines are open and available, so you can call us now. Again, toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. And David Perlman, help us understand a little bit more of the science of this. It's kind of all about photons, isn't it?
Photon science, yes. That's one of the phrases that's often used. A major point, I think, that needs to be made, and Ray Genlos has made it in part, which is that the primary funding for this comes from what's called the Stockpile Stewardship Program, which is an effort to assure the safety and reliability of our current nuclear thermonuclear arsenal by means other than testing underground, which, of course, is now banned, or we hope it will be banned, through a comprehensive test ban treaty. So initiating these thermonuclear blasts in tiny, tiny capsules the size of a pinhead will lead us, one hopes, to a means of studying the basic nature, the basic physics of thermonuclear explosions to a degree that is not as yet understood completely. Ray Genlos, for example, doesn't need to reach the thermonuclear explosion point known as ignition because he studies the great pressures in the centers of stars, in the centers of planets, in the center, indeed, of our Earth. So for him, the ability to just achieve enormous pressures, similar, analogous to the pressures at the center of the Earth and the centers of exoplanets, planets circling other stars, that's real science. The game of the NIF, ultimately, is to assure the safety and reliability of the thermonuclear stockpile. And also, of course, as goes all the way back to the 1970s, when it was first conceived that one might be able to achieve controlled thermonuclear fusion in a machine, ultimately, that became NIF. So that's the science involved. Part military, part basic science, and a combination of the two.
I noticed, though, David, that the Federation of American Scientists is opposed to this project. They say it's too costly. This is, in fact, the most expensive single high-tech project ever, I believe, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. What about the high-tech projects involved in going to Mars with two rovers that are still operating on there?
Yeah, I was thinking about on our planet.
on Earth, standing still, I suppose so. There have been huge linear accelerators and the CERN project in Europe, of course, the Centre, well, I won't say it in French, the Nuclear Center, Research Center in France and Switzerland, obviously is another case in point, the Large Hadron Collider, which is enormously expensive. I don't remember the cost. But, yeah, it's one of the biggest projects the United States, has ever undertaken. And, again, let's remember that it's a dual-purpose facility to satisfy the needs of people who are curious about the center of our Earth and to satisfy the needs of keeping our nuclear weapons safe and reliable. So it's kind of a combination.
Well, I'm going to go to our callers in just a moment, but let me go back to Raymond Genlos for a moment. Professor Genlos, what can one hope or expect this will tell us, for example, about cosmology and the origins of the universe?
Oh, that's a great question. David correctly characterized that there, if you want, two regimes in which this facility will be enormously helpful in revealing new understanding. For us in the astrophysical and planetary realm, really the distinction is, if you want, between stars and planets. And as you know, stars are powered by nuclear reactions, thermonuclear reactions. Planets do not have those thermonuclear reactions. So in that sense, David is exactly right in pointing out that for my own domain of research, I don't actually need the nuclear fusion in order to explore what's going on deep inside not only the Earth, but giant planets like Jupiter, much more massive planets like the ones around other stars. On the other hand, for astrophysicists, those who are interested in processes taking place inside stars, the National Ignition Facility provides, if you want, the first step for being able to recreate in the laboratory some aspects of the conditions existing inside stars. For example, exploding stars such as supernovae, certain of those processes will for the first time be able to be reproduced in the laboratory, and that allows one then to turn to the computer simulations that astrophysicists are want to do for lack of any other information, and to be able to check those computer simulations, make sure that they make sense, and thereby enrich our understanding of these astronomical observations that are made on, I'm just giving you one little example of supernovae, but that example is in fact important because supernova represents, if you want, the set of, they're called standard candles, the beacons in the sky that help us understand the rate at which our universe is expanding. And hence, again, you can see one builds up a story that really enriches and informs our understanding of the universe back to its starting point. I've glossed over a lot of details, but just want to give you a snippet of an understanding of the realm, both for astrophysicists and we in the planetary arena who are looking at new kinds of chemistry that happen deep inside planets. It's very, very enriching, and it'll be really the first time that we can systematically examine some of these phenomena.
Well, no, that snippet is very illuminating, and let me go to our callers and not Terry on that score. AJ from San Diego, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, listening to the discussion just now, from a basic physics standpoint, I can understand the project. For years, we were talking about fusion as being our solution to our energy future. A perspective I no longer hold. My background's in physics, as I was saying to the call screener. A recent study, 2006, by MIT for the DOE, pointed out that we have in the lower 48 states, just from geothermal alone, in excess of 2,000 times the total energy needs of the United States. And, of course, the sun provides the Earth with as much energy in an hour than all humanity consumes in a year. That's just my point. I'll listen on air. Thank you very much.
Okay. We thank you for the call. Comment, Professor John Lowe?
No, the point's well taken. And my own view, not only as an academic scholar but also as a citizen, is absolutely to encourage exploratory research, including, if you want, in the low-tech arenas or using, leveraging off of what we know right now, including conservation and the like. But on the other hand, I think it's also good to have, as part of that mix, a certain amount of the research be at the very high-tech, high-end, sometimes quite expensive, but really also pushing the boundaries of our knowledge, because we may have some breakthroughs in understanding that either provide new sources of energy or, quite frankly, often scientific and engineering breakthroughs actually provide us with answers to questions we didn't even realize we would be asking. So I really appreciate the full spectrum of research that needs to be done in order to keep our society moving forward in an appropriate manner.
And let me move forward appropriately to more calls. David, join us on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. I think it's very interesting that you had the Chevron piece and now the NIF, National Ignition Facility, piece together. I think Chevron represents old energy, and the NIF and fusion, new energy possibilities for the future. Unlimited carbon-free energy is certainly a game-changer worldwide, in all kinds of realms. The Europeans and the Japanese, as I'm sure you know, are heavily involved in research, using different methods to get at fusion, the tokamaks instead of the lasers. So my personal opinion is that this should be funded at a Manhattan Project level, and I'll take my my answer off the air.
All right. I thank you for the call. And by the way, we did invite a spokesperson from NIF, the National Ignition Facility, for today's program, but for reasons inscrutable, they declined to participate. What about, David Perlman, the idea that the caller suggests here, maybe a Manhattan Project to move forward on this because of its importance?
Yeah, it's already a mini Manhattan Project.
I was going to say, it's almost as costly. Yeah,
well,
in today's dollars.
Quite, so, no, yeah. But, yeah, the more it can be pursued, the more thermonuclear fusion research can be pursued, the better. Now, we have to remember, though, that the opposite side of this inertial confinement, that is laser fusion, laser-induced fusion, is magnetic confinement. The problem is when you create a gas, when you get these two elements, deuterium and hydrogen, the various isotopes of hydrogen, put them together, you get this, under enormous pressure, you get a blast. And to confine the blast, that's the principle here of NIF. There have been magnetic systems developed over many, many years. My own experience, unfortunately, is the fact that the first time I ever heard about this stuff, magnetic confinement, was like 40 years ago. And they said, oh, well, fusion is just around the corner. In 20 years, we're going to have unlimited energy from the hydrogen in the seawater. Well, that was 20 years. And 20 years later, they said, in 20 years, we're going to have unlimited energy again. All it takes is some more physics. Well, that's 40 years
Actually, David, I have to jump in here because I'm looking at an email from a listener named Ron who, right on point here, says, my father was working on thermonuclear fusion using lasers in the late 60s and early 70s. This is not the first ignition facility, so we are still funding it about 40 years later. Why has this continued for so long without success, and at what point do we say it's unachievable?
Well, in answer to that, I would say that there are experiments and research going on at very high cost in containing the same principle of containment through magnetic fields, and that's been going on for, as I say, maybe 50, 60 years. And if we ever achieve it, then we've got unlimited energy. It really is true that we do. But whether it will be achieved, I don't know.
Can I jump
in here, Raymond.
Jump in and make a couple of comments. I feel compelled to remind everyone what we all know. Of course, this funding means people are being paid to develop new concepts, to understand new concepts, and actually then build something. And let me just, again, give you a tiny example. In the construction of this facility, what was discovered technically among many other things that were discovered was the incredible purity and refinement of the glass pieces, if you want, the final lenses that are needed to focus these 190-odd laser beams down to that pinpoint. And the fact is that was a new discovery. But as a scientist, I don't want to get hung up on that scientific discovery. At least as important was then converting that into an industrial-scale process where a factory actually had to produce glass with specifications and purities and purity levels and so on, unheard of before. So it really pushed our technological capability as a society as a whole. That's really a large part of what's been paid for, and it's in that sense that I would say already there's been a lot of success technically and also in terms of the capabilities of our society, generally speaking. And of course, we hope that there will be successes soon in terms of the fusion reactions themselves, and perhaps some unanticipated breakthroughs as well.
But, of course, it may not happen. At this point, it's as unknowable as perhaps many of the galaxies out there that we haven't explored. I'm looking at an email here from Matt in Mill Valley, and Raymond Janlos, you may want to address an answer to this. He says, can you address the amount of energy this machine will use? Can it produce enough energy to offset its energy use or maybe run itself?
So that's a very good question. And I think the expectation is the point of this machine is to establish that it can periodically produce at least as much energy, hopefully more energy, through the fusion process than is put into the fusion process. But this is a research machine. If this machine succeeds, or when it succeeds, and when the physics of this fusion process is better understood, I, as a researcher, have enormous respect for the incredible amount of work that then needs to be done to engineer the process and create, if you want, a factory for fusion energy. We don't know whether that'll happen in the next decades, in our lifetime, or whatever, but the point is this is the first little nibble on that, and I want to really emphasize that it will take a whole slew of extra work to then industrialize the process once one has success, whether that success comes with the NIF or with future machines, we don't yet know. But the point is the industrialization and the production aspects, where you then end up having a factory that does put out systematically more energy than is being put in. That's for the future, and that will require a lot more work.
Well, I don't want to sound like the skeptic and naysayer, but David Perlman, I remember all the talk and all the excitement about cold fusion. And as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, to produce energy, this has to be able to fire at 5 times per second, and right now it can only do once every couple of hours, right?
Well, that, of course, depends on the amount of energy you put in terms of megajoules, and I won't even try to define that. That's an amount of energy that's put in. And this thing is supposed to operate at 1.8 megajoules, million joules, a heck of a lot of energy. When it reaches that point, if it does, in a couple of years, maybe 3 or 4, that's the point at which this fusion reaction is supposed to occur. You mentioned, by the way, at the very beginning, why was the Federation of American Scientists opposed to it? There are allegations, of course, and it's not secret or anything, that this is a marvelous machine for training new young physicists in how to make hydrogen bombs. Well, obviously, a lot of knowledge is going to come out of this, and some of it certainly is going to be useful to a new generation of scientists, of physicists, who, in fact, are going to be weapons physicists. Well, who's to say whether in our defense thinking we don't need a new generation? We haven't reached a nuclear test ban, a universal nuclear test ban treaty. We have the example of the North Koreans who have just exploded an underground nuclear explosive. Whether it's thermonuclear or not, I would doubt that. But nonetheless, more and more nations are acquiring nuclear weapons.
Well, you've given me a good moment to add that in our next hour, we're going to be talking to a couple of international experts about really new ways of finding security in this age of more nations acquiring thermonuclear power. I just want to also read Kai from Livermore wrote the email, said, regarding the cost of the facility, let's put it in perspective. It's about $3 billion over more than 10 years, about $2 per year per household. That's less than a penny a day. It's also less than 1/20 of 1% of the total military budget. Yes, it's a high risk, but isn't it worth trying? And another listener wants to know, is the public can actually expect to get information regarding the results of this, or will it remain state secrets? Well, we're going to continue to obviously cover this story, and tomorrow is the big unveiling. I want to thank our guests. Thanks to Raymond John Lowes, who again is professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley, and also to David Perlman, the science editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Another hour of Forum coming your way. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.